here at Berkman Center and co-director of this Law Lab project. This luncheon is one of our Law Lab speaker series luncheons, and I'm particularly pleased today to be able to introduce Matt Dunn to you. Matt is a Vermonter, which, as you know, I'm a Vermonter as well, and that makes me particularly pleased to have him here. But he's his qualifications are much more deep than that. Matt has, as his bio says, focused his life's work on bringing together the worlds of entrepreneurship, service, and politics. He has combined distinguished service across all of those fields. He was elected to the Vermont House of Representatives at the ripe age of 22, and served in the Vermont House for several terms, for 7 years, at which point he then joined the Clinton administration as director of AmeriCorps Vista, which was a wonderful program for service and for young people. He was also returned from that in 2002 and was elected then to 2 terms in the Vermont Senate, so he moved up the pecking order there. Outside of the legislature, he is now working with Google, where he is the director community affairs, I believe, manager, U.S. manager of community affairs. But before that, he also then worked with in the private sector in a variety of jobs, also with Dartmouth, where he's associate director of the Rockefeller Center, in charge of creating programs to support students who wish to pursue careers in the nonprofit sector. And as head of community affairs at Google, Matt supports all aspects of the company's local corporate responsibility activities in the 25 U.S. communities where Google has an office or data center. So he is in many ways the public face of Google, at least to the world of communities where they have their operations. He is married to a wonderful woman named Sarah Taylor, who is quite a noted author. If any of you are interested in mystery stories, she is an excellent mystery author. A little plug there for Sarah. And they have sons Judson and Abraham, and I believe, or is it public?
It is expecting a
third in the summer, which will be make for a busy summer, because in addition to all that, he's running for governor of Vermont on the Democratic Party, and will be facing the primary at the end of the summer or early fall, depending on when the legislature and the governor finally set that date. Mm-hmm. And if he gets through a rather busy field of Democrats, will be in the general election for November. So Matt, take it away.
Great, thank you. I'm going to stand up since I've been sitting down most of the day, and then we'll be leaving as soon as I get the high sign, since we will be heading back to Vermont, where I am participating in a debate on mental health this evening at 5 o'clock at UVM. So it is a busy day, and we're traversing New England, which is just fine. But thank you so much for the introduction and the invitation. It's wonderful to be here at the Berkman Center, and I want to start off by saying a couple of disclaimers. I am not a lawyer, and I cannot write code, which puts me into an interesting position to be talking about technology in this particular place. I am a longtime friend of Andrew McLaughlin, who told me much about his time here, and I understand that he was here 2 days ago, which will, of course, make me look like I know nothing at all. So, delighted to dive in and to talk a little bit about Vermont and a opportunity that I think Vermont has that comes from its lack of opportunity currently. Vermont is known in many circles as the last mile state. We actually have been discussed in that context. We are very rural. We're the most rural state. That doesn't mean that there aren't places that are more spread out than us, but in terms of not having any central city, as defined by Congress, we are a very rural, very spread out state. We have a number of things like mountains and trees, which makes it difficult for the deployment of things over airwaves. And as a result, we have struggled in our ability to create connectivity. However, I'm going to make the case today that because of that position, we are actually the best place to be seen as an experimentation ground for competition in high-speed internet and the uses that would come with it. So let me walk you through why that is. So first of all, there is a clear need
for broadband in Vermont. And we were just talking a little bit about the responses that some communities had about the Google offering of a gig to the home. And while we have not jumped in frozen lakes or in with sharks, the buzz around the state has been very loud, and there are a few reasons for that. The first is that we are dead last in internet connectivity of any state in the country. We are 49th, just to sort of add to that, we're 49th in government transparency. So while the two don't go together, it's an interesting piece of information. We are 48th in using the internet to interact with constituents as a state government. We're 44th in using e-government to engage citizens, and we are 48th in our, in, I think, no, I'm sorry, it was 48th in the transparency of our stimulus money that was spent. So even in the thing where the president has said, this is going to be the most transparent use of government money ever, we came in below Alaska. So we have that with us. And what's fascinating about it is that it is not only, how do I say this, geeks like me that are clamoring for broadband. It is becoming universally understood across the board that it's necessary. It's no longer something that is needed to be able to get ahead. It's something that is now needed to be able to keep up. And we have a couple of examples. I certainly talk to businesses, and I always make the case that I worked for a software company based in Wilder, Vermont, called Logic Associates. And we grew it to 120 employees, which was great, especially for Vermont. And it was started in a barn. And Google was started in a garage. It was started in a dorm room, but then it was really created in a garage. And today, if you don't have high-speed internet, as probably all of you know, to the barn and to the garage, you're not going to get entrepreneurial startups. It's just not going to happen. You're not going to get the connectivity. You're not going to get the low cost of transaction that can come and allow a startup to be able to be successful. But it goes beyond that now. We have employers who have been talking to me about how they can't, they tried to hire engineers from the University of Vermont in a town called Rockingham. And when they got down to Rockingham for the interview, they found out the house they could afford had dial-up, and that their iPhone didn't even work in downtown metropolitan Bellows Falls, and they were in Colorado the next day. It's a matter of being able to actually attract people who are going to be able to expand our existing businesses. But there are other fun examples, and I do tell the story that I got hired by Google to run community affairs while I was at first working out of my house that had dial-up. And I was trying to make up excuses as I went along, and you can imagine, you know, why I needed to be able to pop my email, and why it took me a little while to check my calendar, like 10 minutes, you know, things like that, or what that noise was that was behind me, because I was, of course, sitting in the local coffee shop that had free Wi-Fi, but then I had to get off the phone. Not because I need to go to a next meeting, but because they were closing. So I had those own experiences. But more recently, the ones that I think are fun is that there is the town of Thetford, which is just north, actually a bedroom community for Dartmouth College, is very hilly, and they have a wonderful library. And on Sundays, the parking lot of the library is absolutely chock full. And this wouldn't be so strange, except for the fact that the library is closed on Sundays. But they have a wireless distributor, and so you have an entire community that has taken over. In fact, they buy for parking spaces, and they're all, you know, they wave at each other. Usually the cars are running because they're doing this in the middle of winter, which is certainly not good for the environment or any kind of efficiency standard. And they are just so desperate to be able to get online, and they just work there. They sort of joke about it now. This is happening all over the state of Vermont. So if anyone needs evidence for why there is a need, we also have some uppity groups that are out there, represented by Laredo, who is here at the table, who started actually going out and organizing communities. You know, a little grassroots, get out the populace with the pitchforks to demand that we need to have high-speed internet. And also making the incredible statement that we need high-speed internet to the last mile, not just to the village where it's cheap and easy to drop a T1 line and maybe have some DSL somewhere else, but that it actually has to go to the last mile. And it brings up the notions that you've probably all heard the metaphors for, but that this really is the electricity of our time. And when George Aiken, our former and quite famous, at least in Vermont, governor, brought electricity to the last mile of Vermont, he didn't do it because it was profitable. He did it because it was the right thing to do to bring opportunity to every Vermonter. He also brought the interstate with the same argument. The jury is still out as to whether that was as good an idea. But it is that kind of common benefit that we have arrived at. And I think the state of Vermont, given the fact that I brought this up first in this five-way primary, and now seemingly it's the first thing to roll off the tongue of every Democratic candidate, and the Republican candidate as well, that we are finally getting to some kind of consensus. The other reason, there are a few other reasons why Vermont is going to be a place that is going to be amenable to actually doing this kind of real deployment. I'll get to the competition piece in a second, but we currently have the largest deficit in our state history. It is significant. If we are actually going to get out from under it, we are going to have to do things like what Washington and LA and others have done, which is go to cloud computing, because I, for one, am not going to be cutting off benefits to people with AIDS, which is now being proposed in the legislature, when we could not be running our own little server farms, right? It's kind of an obvious thing to me. And so I think there's going to be a need for us to do things that are lighter and faster. That's all going to take connectivity to be able to do it. We also have some challenges in rural education. As I mentioned, Vermont is the most rural state in the nation, and we have a declining student population. We are now the second oldest state in the country. Maine is first, and we are second. And we have a declining student population that I believe this number is right, that we, a little over a decade ago, had 120,000 K-12 students. We are down to 92,000. This is a precipitous drop, and since we've had this tradition of community-based schools, it leads to some very difficult economies of scale, much less the ability to deliver the kind of curriculum that we all know that our children and or grandchildren need to be able to compete in the 21st century. So the understanding by parents that there is a need to be able to have the connectivity from school to school to allow for sharing teachers, and also understanding firsthand what the digital divide means in terms of access to information for young people. And that, you know, just like in history, it was recognized that students who were in households that had electricity did better than students in households that did not, even when you controlled for income. And the hypothesis, at least, was that those who had electricity could read after dark. And those that didn't, even the candlelight and gas lamps were not the same. They chose not to read and therefore did not get ahead. The same kind of barrier is here today, especially as more and more augmented curriculum is offered online. The expectation is that research that is going to be done, even, you know, they're having third, fourth, and fifth graders doing research on papers because that is the new mode of education, that some have access to it and some simply do not. And so that understanding is in stark relief in Vermont. And so more and more parents are understanding the importance of this kind of connectivity. The other is that there is a desperate need for cell service. You think our internet connectivity is bad, you should try getting a cell phone call. And it's not just for people who like to spend all their time driving down the interstate and have to have their Bluetooth in and talking to people. You're hearing it from landscapers. You're hearing it from people who drive truck. You're hearing it from folks who are middle class and worried about being in touch with their son and daughter because I don't know how all of us survived when that wasn't available, but apparently it is now a necessity to be able to check in on a 12-minute increment. So, but everyone is very hungry to have it, and we have had, because of our environmental standards, great difficulty in actually siting towers. We like the aesthetic view that we have in our state. We don't like plunking large pieces of metal on the top of mountains. In fact, when I proposed just allowing for 20-foot extensions on the top of ski toes at the top, I was beaten back as, you know, the nose under the camel's nose under the tent. So there's a lot of resistance to that. However, there is incredible opportunity if you look at broadband in the broadest concept. If you look at it as agnostic to device, then you have opportunities for being able to use a backbone and a delivery system to not only deliver speed of information and VoIP and other kinds of services to a home, but also to be able, with low aesthetic and environmental impact, to be able to deploy it along the roads, anywhere where you have that pipe going along. The next area is that reason that I think we can be a center for an era of competition in broadband and lead the country is because we have a tradition of the notion of community benefit in Vermont. And I could go into a long, gauzy lecture about, you know, barn building and green up day, which is hard to explain to anyone outside of Vermont, where Vermonters voluntarily on one day go out and pick out up trash on other people's roads. We just do it. Like thousands and thousands of Vermonters just get out and do it. We have town meeting, which is still a level of agency, which you don't see in the rest of the country. Town meeting day, or town meetings are not political devices to gather a large group of people that you've usually vetted ahead of time. It is an open discussion, frequently argument, over the use of funds for a community. And town meeting, I believe, still oversees, if not a majority, one of the largest pieces of tax dollars in our state. And so that sort of sense of a community good has led to a wide variety of cooperative electrical systems. A large number of cooperative grocery stores, more so than you would expect of a state of our size and scale. And so that notion of public entities or public good or serving a public good and expecting that private entities will do so is something that's ingrained in us. It hasn't necessarily translated into the telecom world, but it's something that is if framed the right way, is something that is second nature to Vermonters. My favorite reason for why I believe that Vermont can be the center for innovation and competition in broadband deployment is because the incumbents really don't care. You know, they're like, sure, fine, you have Thetford. That's okay with us. And so you will hear some, you know, griping, and they will hire, you know, 30 lobbyists in Montpelier if there's a bill that comes up or whatever else. I actually remember when I put forward the first broadband grant program back in 2003, because the idea was to put out some limited resources. It actually ended up being very limited resources, but some limited resources to just incentivize private or public sector entities to come and deploy internet to the last mile of communities that had nothing, right? The first thing you had to have is nothing at all, and then you'd qualify, and then you'd do this. And so I put this out there, and we had it on an amendment, and so it showed up in the calendar for this, you know, random committee, and there were the room was filled with wingtips. I was like, huh, this is interesting. And everyone was looking around saying, what are they here for? I don't think they're here for nurse licensing revisions. And it turned out that as soon as they saw this kind of play, none of them wanted to comment. There wasn't any position on it. They were just suddenly very, very interested if the state was actually going to put bonded dollars on the table to start to invite. They wanted to know the parameters. Did I really mean 2 megabits in both directions? Don't you really mean one? All kinds of other like little questions that came along, and it was interesting, and it ended up passing despite the governor opposing it, cutting back the funds to a very $500,000. But we were able to put out some grants and made them happen, and the governor, true to his form, and many governors, I think, are like this, had no fear of going and announcing those broadband grants in the communities that were cheering for having something. But it was an interesting process, mostly because in most other states, if you were to propose actually starting to deploy something that might look like municipal broadband or inviting other people to compete, you'd have them coming in guns blazing and saying, no, you can't possibly do that. We have all these sunk costs, you know, all the arguments. But they really don't care about Vermont. Now, I have to say that because I believe in transparency, and we are going to be podcasting this, we may suddenly get an infusion of cash into Vermont from all the people they will be hiring because they're now worried about it, but that's okay. Because they better find out about it now, because again, they still can't find the justification within their metrics for being able to deliver to most of Vermont, and they just won't do that. And so their interests and focus will be on other states in other places. In the meantime, we can do some really creative and interesting work. And the final piece that gives us an advantage in doing this, which we'll get to how I'm proposing to do it, is that we actually have a AAA bond rating in Vermont. For our fund, we have the cheapest money of any municipality in the country. Much cheaper than California, let's say, that you might think would be on the leading edge, who I think is now has the most expensive, and other states who had not been fiscally prudent for a period of time do not have the kind of capacity outside of what they may get from the federal government to be able to start to play in the sandbox and to do so with autonomy. I'm sure all of you saw the New York Times piece that came out just sort of describing how the broadband plan has rolled out. And to many people, including some of the people that I work with in my day job, you know, there's a sense that there's been some giving up on whether or not we're going to be disruptive to the current incumbents, whether we're going to actually be out there saying, you know what, we need competition. We need access to common pipes. We need to open the boxes on top of television sets. We need to do the kinds of things that will lead to competition. We don't want to do it in ways that that bankrupt people who have done the deployment. Frankly, they don't need our help in Vermont since Fairpoint has gone bankrupt. But even within that understanding, there isn't apparently a national consensus. That is the direction that we need to go in the same way as it has in other countries that are able to deploy to consumers much faster connectivity and has opened up an incredible variety and diversity of products that are only able to be provided online and in real time. So the fact that we have these resources available to us, it doesn't hurt that our good Senator Patrick Leahy is on appropriations and I think would love nothing more than to be able to help facilitate the deployment of broadband to the state that he loves. But it is an advantage that we have that's unique, along with our size and scale. So we have, you know, 620,000 people. I believe the estimate for a private company to come in and do at least 500 megabits to the home is somewhere in the $450 to $500 million range, which when I say that to Vermonters, they all go, oh my God, that sounds like a huge amount of money. And I am not proposing that Vermont pay for that. But in the grand scheme of things, in the ability to be able to see what this would look like to have that kind of competitive pipe, to have the forces from around the country that are excited about a demonstration project to show that you can actually deliver at a much lower cost, it's actually a really good case to be able to make. There will be a lot of uptake from all those people in Thetford and others. There will be a lot of interest. And then we are also strategically located in close proximity to major innovation and metropolitan centers. If you look at Vermont, it's not that much bigger than the entire technology triangle of North Carolina. And if you put at the corners, rather than the cities in North Carolina, Montreal, Boston, and New York, you actually have this sort of this center that can be a center of innovation that individuals who, say, might work for an esteemed Ivy League school in the Boston area who wanted to spend much more time in Vermont could do so and could be a part of the community in both places if there was connectivity that really worked. We already have people who do that commute on a regular basis, but it would allow for a nice center of both in-person as well as online connectivity that would be second to none. And so the proposal that I'm putting on the table as a candidate for governor, but frankly as a citizen that wants to make sure that we actually allow young people and jobs to come back to our state, would actually be to put some dollars on the table, bonded dollars. This is a long-term investment, as well as guarantees from our AAA bond rating in order to allow for the private sector to come forward with a commitment, whether it's through a municipal mechanism, a nonprofit mechanism, or a for-profit mechanism. I'm quite agnostic as long as they are actually deploying to the last mile and they are allowing for access to that pipe at a reasonable and appropriate cost. A governor in Vermont, the exciting thing about governors in Vermont is that they actually have a lot of power. It is a state that it keeps it in check on a regular basis, including two-year terms, which are a little brutal, but in terms of being able to work with the Public Service Department and Public Service Board to be able to move regulations along that might reinforce some of those parameters, or to be able to deploy the dollars that are available, much less to be able to orient so that we can have things like clarity that you can string glass on the lower part of utility poles. Right? And this may seem like a very strange, random thing, but it saves a whole lot of money to be able to string there rather than having to hire people to put it between high voltage units at a higher end of the utility pole. The same with micro-trenching. We can move regulations very, very quickly to accommodate, particularly for a something that's considered a utility deployment. And so if there were places that were not bothered by frost or rocks that go to the center of the earth, we could actually do fast-moving micro-trenching as well. And then there's WiMAX in addition. The other piece that I think is really exciting is the potential for low-frequency spectrum deployment in Vermont as well. And again, if someone asks me, do you think you need fiber or WiMAX or other methods, my answer is yes, right? That competition is good. Mechanisms for deployment is good. They all have their pros and cons. But in Vermont, we actually use the smallest amount of the old television spectrum of any state in the country. We didn't have a whole lot of television stations to begin with, and we didn't put up a lot of towers for using them because they didn't get very far, right? They did go through mountains better than some things, but so we actually have a lot of spectrum that's available. And again, we don't have a lot of people who will make a big fuss about experiments that would actually use that low frequency spectrum, and it would solve a number of problems on a variety of levels. Again, because we have towers in existence, you can deploy, and it can be a good augmentation to it as well. And I would be excited to see what kinds of things that you could actually deploy by that. So. Again, this may not have been the place that you would have first thought, but I think there is an excellent case that Vermont can go from worst to first, that we can actually be the state that goes from the strength, much like some third world countries have found, of having nothing to be able to go to next generation without people pushing back, with the resources to be able to do it, and the sense of community that will actually understand the importance of making it open and accessible and competitive for the long term. There's a professor at UVM who once made the statement that it was as if Vermont was on the race with other states on a round track. We got so far behind, we ended up ahead. And that is, I think, true in a number of cases. In this one, the being behind, we really are feeling it right now. But the potential to be able to leapfrog and to be able to deliver is very, very real. So that's the presentation. But I would love to hear questions on this hypothesis. Yeah.
Jump in very briefly to say that remind people we are being podcast and streamed, and so your participation in our dialogue constitutes your consent to participate in that streaming and podcast.
The state just east of you is also rural and mountainous. What have they done differently, and what can you possibly do that they've done, or do you not want to do that they've done?
The state to the east of you mean that New Hampshire thing that's over there? Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So New Hampshire, you know, it's interesting. I have not looked. It looks like a small river. But it is very big in many ways. In my area, I went to Hanover High School. I grew up in Vermont, went to Hanover High School in Hanover, New Hampshire, because we actually have a bi-state education system, which I believe was the first in the country and had to be constitutionally allowed. So I know a lot about what's going on at Dartmouth. And the outside of what they've done on campus, which is really interesting, the experimentation they've done with having, I believe, one of, if not the first, unleashed campuses, was really fascinating, just to see what happened with student behavior and the like. Beyond that, they're facing, as I understand it, the same kind of challenges. And yet, in my strange way of arguing this, their disadvantage is that they have a much more densely populated center of gravity at the southern part of the state. And as a result, they've got a number of incumbents who have a whole lot of interest in making sure that they maintain control over the deployment of content or any other mechanism in that area. So I think the spread of need would not be as great, and I think they would see other challenges. Is there a specific example that you're thinking of that?
No, I'm just thinking of it as a state that is somewhat similar to yours.
Somewhat similar.
Yeah.
Although they do go about things a lot differently, and in fact, that sense of community, a community good, as opposed to private property. Is one of, the big distinguishing features between the two states.
Matt, another problem with New Hampshire, frankly, is the hostile regulatory environment. Vermont regulations and the regulatory environment in Vermont is much more conducive to the type of vision that Matt has. New Hampshire is simply hostile to it at a regulatory level. It won't happen there anytime soon without political change.
You also have the other interesting thing for the political scientists in the room is that New Hampshire is one of the weakest governors in the country. And for those of you who don't know, the governor is on a two-year term, but from the moment they appoint a secretary or cabinet member, that person has a six-year term. And you can actually start that, as I recall, since my wife's uncle was commissioner of agriculture, and I believe he got named that with a month and a half to go in one governor's term, and then proceeded to do good progressive ag work across the state for many years through governors of other parties. So the ability for the governor to do anything is really challenging there. And even at that point, you have to go through an executive council. It's the only one left in the country, which has to oversee, I believe, any budget item of over $1,000. And those were elected officials. So the ability to do this kind of fast-moving, bonded authority to be able to deploy is just difficult.
We actually have a governor's council too, stripped of almost all that authority.
Is there still one in Massachusetts?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. In New Hampshire, it is still very much alive and well. Yeah?
But New Hampshire also have a town hall meeting structure where people do get together. In many ways, because of the opposition to certain beliefs that Vermont does not share with New Hampshire, it might be more beneficial to try it there.
In New Hampshire?
Yes.
Because of why?
Because the private property rights is much more enforced there.
Well, it depends. I mean, if the case is going to be when you get into a committee room, I'm not going to name any names like Comcast or AT&T, but we're at the end of the table and saying, look, we have spent all of this money on this infrastructure. We need to recoup it, and we don't trust that we are going to be able to recoup it, and you're changing the rules on us after the fact if we're going to open this up, and you can't allow someone else to come along and just destroy our entire business model. I think in a place that has stronger, and this is not to say that Vermont doesn't have property rights, trust me, they're strong, but that sort of sense of a community good as something that you do regulatorily has not been the culture in New Hampshire as it has been in Vermont. I mean, Vermont was the first state to prohibit dropping someone from insurance because of pre-existing conditions. Right? That was a regulatory move. New Hampshire did not do that. And so it, I think it just sort of speaks to, again, in a regulatory space, the idea that we look at things as more of a community and therefore would be more open to this. I'm not saying it's going to be easy, but that it's plausible.
I would suggest it goes back to the third world country and the idea that where the infrastructure is not already in place, it's a lot easier to put the infrastructure in place. And in New Hampshire, southeast New Hampshire really has a strong infrastructure. And the net gain in New Hampshire would not be as great as the net gain.
The advantage, though, that we do have, which is interesting, is that we do have lots of rail lines that come through Vermont, which, of course, means access to fiber, since it's the easiest place to drop it. And because White River Junction was the railroad hub of New England for a while, and a little factoid that 10% of the entire population of Vermont, New Hampshire, 10% of the entire population of the U.S. and Canada during the 20s would pass through White River Junction on an annual basis. So you got lots and lots of lines coming in, lots and lots of options for being able to drop in the backbone and the ability to deploy. Yeah?
I mean, Hanover was just cited as having one of the top 10 download speeds in the whole United States.
Interesting.
New Hampshire. Yeah, it was up there. I mean, there's Japan, and then there's
right.
Europe, and then there's us, but then there's Hanover.
And then there's Hanover,
so
right.
So it's something. Where's the data? I mean, because I was just sort of ghosting around really briefly last night looking for data on internet connectivity by state. I was looking for maps. I didn't spend a lot of time at it, but where is that data? Because when you say that Vermont is the least connected state in the union, having lived in West Virginia and
yeah.
owning property there,
yeah.
I'm skeptical.
Sure. So you will actually find on the announcement of this talk, we've actually put some references and some links below it, which has the source that I'm using for that connectivity. If you talk to some other people, we may be 48th, depending on how you measure the connectivity. But that's where it's based. And I believe Brookings that did the, David, I'm trying to remember the.
It's called speedmatters.org, and 47% of Vermonters
have 100 kilobits.
Under 768.
Under 768.
Which is how the FCC defines broadband. Alaska's 49th at 45%.
So it's percent.
Virginia? I would have to look.
The link is on there, and I encourage you to take a look at it. But more and more people are taking a look at it, and this is with, Burlington having actually built out a fiber telecom system. So, even with that, we are way, way behind. Other questions? Yeah.
More specifically, are you proposing offering state financing and guarantees in exchange for open access?
And last mile. Yep.
Yeah. How much of the state are you hoping to? Are you going to go and overbuild on top of existing areas, or are you trying to go into areas where there is not coverage?
What I want to do is allow for that guarantee to allow people to come to the table and decide how it is they want to deploy, and if there is some overlap. Then there's some overlap. If there is not, that's also fine. If it's coming from an in-state incumbent of sorts, that's fine. I mean, it's going to be agnostic as long as they're able to do that kind of deployment. Yeah?
I would suggest, too, that you're sort of helping those incumbents to have some reason to come to the table and to leverage those people and those networks that are already in existence for the last mile. When you're willing to underwrite the last mile. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I understand what you're saying. I mean, the financing of it is kind of up in the air.
Exactly.
But we do have that opportunity, which just has to do with the desperate need is so high that the uptake, the subscription rate, is likely to be very, very high in those particular locations.
Yeah. Have you looked at some of extensively in Europe?
A bit. I wouldn't claim to be an expert on it, but
It's something to look at.
Sure.
The notion of signing people up in advance reduces the risks of.
Oh yeah, yeah. That's been done for a while. In fact, Laredo's group has done bits of that. We also have people who, on their own, go and try to bring petitions to Comcast and say, please, can you bring something out?
So has that been effective in Vermont? Are people doing that already? Or are they?
Well, you have to understand, we haven't started construction yet. And so until you've started construction, aggregating demand sort of is a pretty theoretical activity, which is like, if we build this in a few years, would you use it? Mm-hmm. And the answer is a resounding yes, but hey, let's build it. And the proposal that we'd like to try is go down a road, wire up the road with fiber, and then go to every house and say, we're converting 100% of this road to our fiber network. Do you want to try it for a month? Mm-hmm. And if they say yes, you connect them up. At that rate, everybody's going to say yes, and we would convert a road at a time, a community at a time, and flip it to 100% fiber.
Convert meaning basically discontinue the copper?
Precisely. Yeah.
But if at the end of the month they say, no, we don't want it anymore.
I want to allow this conversation to continue. I'm going to have to get on the road, and I'm also not feeling particularly well, so if I stand much longer, but I want to just thank
everyone for participating in this. My website is mattdunn.com. It's Dunn with an E. If you leave off the E, you get a Hollywood photographer who's very confused as to what Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant is and why everyone's so concerned about it. But please do be in touch, and I appreciate your time and your interest. So, thank you.
We do have here, Laredo, if you would introduce yourself, because in terms of another exhibit from Vermont, we have a few more minutes to chat. Laredo is deeply involved in a project called, I believe it's EC Fiber, which is aimed at being one of these publicly oriented last mile fiber initiatives. Yeah. So if you would take a moment, that would be great.
I'm itching to talk, I'll tell you. In a sense, what Matt presented to us is sort of chapter one, and I can talk about chapter two. Chapter two being the organization of municipalities into aggregate coalitions that have sufficient numbers of subscribers and sufficient mass to develop their own telecom systems. So the concept is universal coverage, number one. Number two, open access. Number three, FTTH, fiber to the home everywhere. And it's owned by municipalities participating. The municipalities form coalitions, either municipal utility districts or interlocal contracts. And in the process of binding themselves together, we can create a 21st century fiber infrastructure. Because it's open access, we can open up those pipes to competitive carriers, as Matt was talking about, or as I prefer to think of it, as innovation. I believe that in the future, if pipes are open with open access, there's going to be amazing innovative services offered over those pipes that simply aren't going to be offered through Comcast, Verizon, and other proprietary approaches. In rural areas, there's only enough money and it only makes sense to have one fiber to every house. It doesn't make sense to have redundant infrastructure. In that kind of an environment, the fiber should be a publicly controlled and publicly owned and publicly operated utility. It's the same thing as the roads, it's the same thing as the post offices, and we have historical precedent for this in the form of utility networks, electric networks that were owned by municipalities or by municipal utility districts. This is not new. This is part of the rural American tradition. All we're doing is taking the electric model and updating it and saying, today it's fiber that we're running on this same utility structure. And the only way this is going to happen in America, if history is any indication, is if the municipalities organize ourselves and do it for ourselves. That's the only way this is going to happen. It's happening in central Vermont right now, and folks, it's happening in your backyard. Western Mass is organizing itself. There's a group of between 30 and 40 towns, we'll know in a couple months exactly how many, in Western Mass who are building a municipal organization that is designed and targeted along the same lines, following the same template as EC Fiber. So what we're seeing is an emergent movement. What we're seeing is the tip of a revolution where rural communities, rural towns, are organizing themselves into critical masses to build state-of-the-art fiber networks. It's happening in Western Mass over the next 2 months. The towns will be voting. The first town in Western Mass, Shelburne, voted a few weeks ago. It passed unanimously at the Shelburne town meeting. A few weeks before that, Pittsfield, a town in Vermont, voted to join EC Fiber. 100% of the residents of Pittsfield at town meeting voted to join EC Fiber. There was a straw poll taken after that vote. They asked the people at the town meeting, how many of you will be subscribers? 100% of the town will subscribe to EC Fiber to be part of this fiber network. When you look at the numbers, when you look at the economic model, fiber in rural areas makes sense if you can get high subscription rates. All indications are that we will have somewhere above 80% subscription rates when these networks are built. This is a revolution in broadband across America. The other thing I'd like to say, just for 1 minute, about the FCC and their plan to support wireless for rural areas. Rural communities need the best broadband infrastructure. We don't need second-rate infrastructure. And the reason why we need the best is because we really need it to use it. We have to create episodes of virtual reality. We have to have the most sophisticated services because we are so distant. So the notion that rural areas can subsist on some sort of substandard wireless broadband is a lot of hooey as far as I'm concerned. The only question we should be asking ourselves is, number one, how do we organize ourselves politically? Number two, how do we pay for this financially? What's the business model? Is it affordable? And the news, folks, is it's very affordable. You can construct an entire telephone company in a box that's the size of a mini refrigerator that sits on the table. That's the kind of evolution of the technology that has happened that has reduced the cost and complexity of these networks to commodities that can be purchased and plugged together. So the news that you should take back to your rural friends is get yourselves organized. The revolution is about to happen. We can do this, and we can spread this template, we can spread this model across rural America. Now, I'd like to go into a lot more depth, but I've already spoken way too much.
I appreciate that. What about the you talk about the box for the software management and all that kind of thing, but
the thing that's always daunting is the fiber on the poles, because that's not the end of the world expensive, but it's not cheap either, and that's I think what people keep looking at is it. Well, you've got a road with five houses on it over a mile. Is that going to support putting a piece of fiber up there?
There are some neighborhoods where it's expensive to run fiber, and there are other neighborhoods where it's cheap to run fiber. And so what you do is you approach it as a community, and you say the benefit, the economic development, the economic benefit happens when a business can locate in a community and know that every person that they're going to hire within a 50-mile radius is connected to a high-quality fiber network to their home. So that means that when the sleet storm comes, those employees can still work. That's where the economic benefit comes. This notion of we're going to wire up all the institutions in Vermont with fiber, that's a great idea, but it doesn't have a significant benefit economically to the community. Because that business that Matt was talking about locating locally has to understand and has to know that the employees can connect to the businesses, i.e. we have to have fiber to every single home in the community. That's fundamental to the benefits that come out of this. Some roads are not cost effective. Other roads generate a huge profit. So put it all together, and the key metrics here are what is the average number of homes per mile? And what we discover is that we can build fiber networks cost effectively. Thank you, Matt.
I'll leave it to the other promoters. Thank you so much for the time, and pleased to be in touch.
Thank you. Thanks. Matt mentioned cell phone coverage is another big need in the area. How does fiber address that, or does it, or is it a separate thing?
No, that's absolutely a great question, and let's talk about that for just a minute. The reason why cell phone coverage is so bad is because they can't locate antennas in as many places as they need to. And when they do locate them, they have to build very large 30, 40-foot antennas because there's so few of them. If you have a ubiquitous fiber network providing ubiquitous, high-quality backhaul, then you can locate your antennas in small and unobtrusive places and get 100% wireless coverage, whether that's cell phone, Wi-Fi, WiMAX, or some other future wireless technology. So the answer is build your wireless on top of your fiber network. That's the thing that makes sense, especially in hilly Vermont.
Yeah, I would add that geographic challenges here in Vermont, in the places where you have a valley that just happens to come together so steeply that no cell coverage is possible there without it being along some kind of fiber loop like that.
Yeah, you just put up your little small antennas along the fiber loops.
Last couple questions, and then we'll break.
Take one quick number question. What's the range of household monthly revenue you would need for the break even for some of these things?
Good question. I was just beginning to get to that when I said goodbye to Matt. There's several factors that play together. One is the ARPU, the revenue per user, and then the other one is how many houses per mile, and then the third part of that equation is what's your take rate of the houses per mile, how many will become subscribers. Okay, so when you're looking at the economics of a network, you have to look at all three together because they multiply together, and it's the product of those three that counts, not any one single piece of that. But to cut to the chase, to answer your question, we believe that we can build a profitable, self-sustaining, self-financing network with an ARPU of approximately $130 a month for full triple play services. That's telephone, television, and a very large amount of high-speed internet. Okay, so ARPU, average revenue per household of $130 a month, assuming that we have 12 houses per mile, and assuming that 60% of those 12 houses become subscribers. I firmly believe, based on the ground experience, that when you get to rural areas where there's no competition, that you're going to get better than 90% subscription rates. And the reason why I believe this is because I've talked to my neighbors, and hundreds of other people have talked to their neighbors, and because we had this vote recently in Pittsfield where 100% of the town said they would become subscribers. So when you look at the subscription rate going from 60% to 80 or 90%, the ARPU can drop substantially and you can still get to break even. Or you can wire up more rural communities that don't have an average of 12 houses per mile. But in fact, across Vermont, we have an average of 12 houses per mile. So we don't even need to go below that. So we can break even at around 60-65% take rate with an ARPU of 130 with the demographics of Vermont. We're going to far exceed that in the actual build-out of this network.
Well, you can see whatever Vermont may lack in connectivity, we make up for in passion, which is good.
I would love to come back and lay this out in systematically in a structured fashion for you, if you're interested.
That would be great. Thank you very much for attending. Thank you very much. The formal ends now, but the opportunity to keep talking for a bit continues. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Yeah, you know, satellite channels have some.